This is Kathy.
Oh, I was wondering. Oh my.
This is it.
I won't be able to sit home.
Okay.
It's the liaison. This liaison, like it is the last.
Yep.
Okay. I would like to call the meeting to order. This is Legislation, Audit, and External Affairs. Sharon, would you please call the roll?
Trustee John Butler.
Here.
Trustee Manuel Sanchez.
Here.
Trustee Myron Siegel. Trustee Barbara Georgie Vella.
Here.
Student Trustee Matthew Venice.
Here.
Chair Sherilyn Muir.
Here.
DOT Chair Mark Strauss.
Here.
Thank you.
Mr. Davidson, would you please confirm that appropriate notices of this meeting have been provided?
Yes, Madam Chair. All appropriate notices have been distributed and posted as required by law at least 48 hours in advance of this meeting. And with an appropriate quorum physically present, I recommend you proceed with the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Davidson. May I have a motion to approve the committee agenda as proposed?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carried. I need a motion to approve the minutes of the February 4th, 2010 LAEA committee meeting.
I'll move it.
Second.
Second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Motion approved. This morning, we again, as always, like to welcome the University Advisory Committee representatives, Mr. Montero, President of the Operating Staff Council. Nice to see you this morning. And Mrs. Eric, I have learned today that this is your last meeting with us.
It is.
And it's very sad for us on a personal basis as well, and I should say Dr. Cesaris.
Thank you.
We spoke before the meeting, and you told me of some of the things that you have planned. The university will truly miss you, and certainly we will miss you at this committee meeting.
I appreciate that.
And
thank
you're
you
retiring
so much.
After 30 years, is that correct?
33.
30, well, who's counting after? Who's counting?
Well, let's
who's
see.
30 years, that's outstanding. Would you like to make a few comments at your last meeting?
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it. I was so hopeful that I would have the opportunity to introduce the new president of the Supportive Professional Staff Council, but we've had a few glitches in our election, so I'm fortunately that you will not be apprised of that individual until your August meeting, but they will sit in my position and carry forward to bring information back to the University Council and to the Supportive Professional Staff with regards to the workings of this committee. But I've so thoroughly enjoyed my opportunity to serve on behalf of the Supportive Professional Staff and be involved in the shared governance program at our institution. It's a fabulous process, and the opportunity to see the integrated work of everyone moving the university forward and keeping it vibrant has been just fabulous, and I really appreciate, again, this opportunity.
Well, you and Mr. Montero have been exemplary, and really you provide a very important voice, not only to this committee, but to this board. So congratulations to
you,
and we wish you the very best.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
You're not retiring from golf.
No, not retiring from
Thank
golf.
Goodness.
I'm going to play more.
Obviously, the very best of wishes, and be seeing you at the golf course sometime.
I will. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Right. And I'd also like to introduce one other individual in the audience, Mr. Robert am I saying it right? Sorsby, who's the Student Association President. Welcome. Oh, and you'll be our new trustee. I didn't know that. Well, that's great. Well, you have big shoes to fill, though. Matt's done a fantastic job. All right. At this point in our agenda, we recognize any members of the public who have complied with state law and Board of Trustee bylaws by registering their request to address the board with our parliamentarian. Mr. Davidson, have you received any timely requests?
Madam Chair, I've received no timely requests.
All right, I think we'll then proceed. As you've seen this morning, everyone has been very dutiful in terms of trying to be attentive to the time, and that's because we have a special meeting following. But there are so many issues that have come up before legislative and audit. And in some ways, it's two sides. You know, the legislation is what drives our money, and the audit assures that we have been meticulous in its disbursement. We know what has been going on in Springfield, and since February, the General Assembly has considered hundreds of bills and passed a historic pension overhaul for new state employees as of January 1st, 2011. Any such changes not necessarily disturbing, but they're disruptive. And so as we see changes, we need to acclimate. But there's fallout no matter what happens on these types of bills. The university report item 7G contains a detailed analysis of the pension code amendments that were enacted. And we're going to skip this item during our meeting, but we really do suggest that the board become familiar with what has happened related to pension funds in now and in the future. I believe it was in, when did we go to Springfield, Kathy? In the end of March?
Yes.
The end of March. There was a contingency of the board that went to Springfield with Dr. Peters and Ms. Bittner. And we met with legislators. It's almost incredulous that the amount of money that is owed to this university by the state of Illinois. And at this moment, there's $44 million outstanding. $44 million outstanding in this fiscal year, which ends June 30th. So, you know, when we manage within our budget, that's one thing, but when we try to manage within a budget that doesn't receive the funds that are necessary, it becomes absolutely incomprehensible. And we are very blessed to have such leadership as Trustee Sanchez indicated in his Finance Committee meeting. Those are not empty words that we all echoed. We are blessed to have the leadership of Dr. Peters and Dr. Williams as it relates to the fiscal management of the university. In this regard, though, Kathy, as our government affairs liaison and the most knowledgeable in that area, would you give a brief report of any pending legislation with the General Assembly?
Yes, Madam Chair. And if you'll look in your board books, your committee books, page 10, I picked out just a couple of bills in the interest of time. House Bill 4706, we've talked about a little bit in the past. That is a bill that would repeal the dependent tuition waivers for children of university employees. And that has, I'm pleased to report, has not progressed and remains in the Rules Committee. I doubt very much, given the rules in the House, that this bill will be dealt with during this spring session. It can come back up again for a vote, obviously, next year, and we would have to deal with that then. The second, page 11, House Bill 5664, which involves sprinkling of the Greek housing. This is kind of a new concept. It actually passed the House. It is now over in the Senate for consideration. Basically, it indicates that automatic fire sprinkler systems need to be put in all brand new Greek housing structures built after January 1st of 2011 for existing homes, Greek housing. They have to be installed and operational by January 1st, 2019. And of course, there's no funding to address this, just like there was no funding to address the university residence hall's sprinkler system mandates a few years ago. So I draw that to your attention. It has passed the House. It is in the Senate. I do expect that bill to pass. Page 13 in your presentation, and I'm just going to highlight this, Senate Bill 51. That bill actually did pass. It is law, and Dr. Cunningham is going to be giving a detailed presentation about that legislation, which does take effect July 1st. So at the end of this meeting, towards the end, you will see how drastically procurement will change as of July 1st for this institution and every other public university and state agency. So it is not only significant for this board in terms of authority but it is also significant for every one of us on the campus who has to learn a new process by which we're going to be able to buy things now. Page 15, Senate Bill 642 is basically the borrowing bill. We've talked about this in the past. It is a bill that none of the universities are, frankly, overly wild about in terms of thinking it's a great thing. But because of the deficit, if you will, in funds coming from Springfield that Chair Murray just talked about, it is an option that the universities have requested from the legislature should funding not be available from the state, again, to keep the doors open at the universities and keep the payroll moving. The bill passed the Senate. It is in the House. It is in negotiations with the sponsor. And frankly, I am uncertain as to how this is going to turn out. So it is, like I say, not something that we would really like to see happen, but it is something that we could put in, as the president says, in our tool chest if the state is further delinquent in paying its obligations to the university. Senate Bill 1946, Pension Credit Service Leave of Absence, that bill did pass. It was signed into law, and your summary of that legislation is contained in item 7G in your board books, and I would encourage you to review that. Senate Bill 2887 on page 16, Procurement Lease File Review. This legislation passed the Senate, and it's over in the House right now, and it is of concern to the university presidents and to the business people, officers like Dr. Williams, who are responsible for negotiating these leases under this procurement code. So this is yet another issue of regulatory oversight and rulemaking that further diminishes the flexibility of the university. So we are working on that in Springfield. It did pass the Senate. I'm not really sure, frankly, how that one is going to come out. Senate Bill 3222, Public University Tuition. That bill did pass the Senate, and it is now in the House. It is actually coming up for a vote on the House floor. It got out of committee this past week. And basically, this bill, it would extend the payment cycle under the truth in tuition. Right now, truth in tuition says, by statute, if you come in as a freshman, you have four continuous years, where you pay the same price as when you went in. Each university has added a grace period to that. At NIU, it's been an extra semester, so you basically have the same price for nine semesters. But the bill that passed the Senate now would basically extend the truth in tuition provisions so that they would, a student who didn't graduate within that time frame and the initial truth in tuition legislation would be able to come in at the university, at the level that they would have been charged when they were the year following them. It's very complicated, but it's basically, it allows them not, in other words, otherwise, if you came in at nine semesters, you would have a big jump coming, 4 years worth of a jump. This basically is 2 years worth of a jump as opposed to four. So it is something that is in the House, and we do expect that bill to pass. Just a couple other quick ones. This is an encouraging bill, a resolution actually, that passed the House already, sponsored by our own Representative Pritchard. They're establishing a Blue Ribbon Committee on Higher Education Mandates within the Board of Higher Ed to review the state mandates on public universities, and we intend to be very engaged in that committee. The page 19, H.R. 1020, some of you may remember, and I know most of the board members were involved in this. This is a resolution that was sponsored by Representative Pritchard and passed to congratulate John LaTourette for the renaming of Faraday West. And of course, we presented Dr. LaTourette and his wife with that resolution about 2 weeks ago when he was on campus. Okay. That ends my substantive report, and I'd be glad to answer privately any questions on other bills.
Thank you.
I've got a quick question. Mm-hmm. Yes. On the borrowing bill, mm-hmm. The state owes us $40 million right now. We go to a bank and say we'd like to borrow $40 million, and the bank says, how are you going to repay it? And we say, well, the state of Illinois is going to backstop on us on that one. How far do you think we're going to get with that process? Am I missing something?
That is one of the major issues why the universities have not been so wild about this, because they know the reality, and you know, we know the reality.
Right.
The presidents have been engaging in this discussion now for weeks, because while it is an option, it is something that we are going to be met with the very grim reality by a banker saying, well, how are you going to pay it back?
Well, now, of course, if Dr. Peter says, well, I will vouch for that.
Yeah, let me jump in here.
Okay, this is where you're coming,
but,
John.
The state, under the various forms that this bill has taken, and there are some rather difficult amendments attached to the current version that creates obstacles and accountability, but this would not permit us to borrow against expected state revenues. That would be problematic, and the state does not put the full faith and credit of the state behind any borrowing that a university would do under this bill. And so you either have an option to borrow or raise revenue bonds or whatever, bounced against income fund tuition, because that is something that comes to us directly, and there are limitations in the bill on how much you could do that, or a line of credit, so you would draw on, you'd set up a business line of credit. Unfortunately, with a line of credit, the interest rates associated with a line of credit are very different than with the bonding. So, as we've said many times, I do not believe that it's very good public policy, and yet it may be the only option available to us in the event that the state lapses $40 million and then in the new fiscal year continues not to pay us. So this lapse and this cash flow rolls to the point where you've exhausted all your reserves and you've drained all your income fund, so you can't meet payroll. Then what do you do then? And we watch this all the time. We're very concerned about this.
Any other questions? I just have one question. Tied to the lapse in payment, is there an interest, a mandated interest being paid on the monies owed?
On the lapse? That's only for dentists.
Yeah.
No, there is not. That's been considered. The other part about the borrowing bill, there is interest associated with anything.
So I'm looking at it both ways. Yes. Is the state mandate, when they don't pay you on time, is there a provision that they're mandated to pay interest on that money that's owed?
No, there is among some providers, like dentists, we're thinking that would be in a, well, no, the answer is no. And then we did try in the current legislation to get the state to pay the interest on anything we borrow,
right,
and that has not gotten
that anywhere. That could mitigate any interest, at least. If they're paying one side, it still will cost you more on a borrowing.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Thank you, Kathy. Because of the shortness of our time today, we will not discuss the congressional report during this morning's meeting, but this information is listed in the board materials as item 7C. The next item on the agenda, I would like to ask Bob Albanez, Associate Vice President of Finance and Facilities, to provide the committee with a summary of the university's fiscal year 2009 financial audit. Normally, the Auditor General's office releases both the financial and compliance audits within a few weeks of each other, but this year, the Auditor General's office has informed us that they will be late with it, and probably not till the end of May before the compliance audit will be released. So I ask Bob to brief the committee on the financial report, please.
Okay, Kathy gave me 3 minutes, so I'm on the clock here. Good morning. I would like to give the committee a brief update on NIU's fiscal year nine financial audit. First of all, I would like to introduce and thank our university controller, Keith Jackson, and the entire controller's office for the outstanding job they do in putting together the financial data for the report. It's literally a six-month job for them. The fiscal year 09 compliance audit is normally presented at the same time as we do the financial audit. But this year is still being negotiated with the Auditor General and has yet to be released. We expect that to be released sometime in May, Keith? Hopefully in May. And after we're through negotiating with the Auditor General, we'll probably have this as an agenda item on next LAEA's meeting. While last year the financial audit had one audit finding, I'm happy to report this year we have zero financial audit findings. That's always a good thing. I just want to make one point concerning our financial condition as I reviewed this report with Keith and the controller's office. During fiscal year 09, our general revenue appropriation decreased by over $1 million. That was the appropriation from the state to NIU. However, we were still able to show an increase in net assets of $6 million. So our state support decreased by $1 million, and our overall operation showed an increase of $6 million in net assets. Now, in private companies, net assets is equal to book value. So we were able to increase the book value of NIU by $6 million when state support decreased by $1 million. What this means is that we were able to protect programs and operations in light of reduced state support. In addition, and this is a key point, what this increase in net assets really does, it validates the pricing model we use for tuition and fees. And that's a key factor as we move forward into much tougher times, that we have a pricing model for tuition and fees that's accurate and really meets the needs of NIU. Any questions?
I don't think so. Thank you so much. You did a great job.
Extra minute.
Extra minute. Well, I think it will be important to see the compliance audit. So as soon as that is delivered, we want to have access to that. But I was very pleased to hear that we had no deficiencies in our audit, no sanctions. That was excellent. You know, things keep moving, don't they? And they keep changing. And FOIA, which has always been important to assure that public universities and public organizations make available documents to the public. And so there is the Freedom of Information Act that has been stable for, I don't know when it was initiated, Mr. Davidson, but for quite some time, the enactment of that. But apparently now there's a new law that has modified and expanded the Freedom of Information Act. And so that means that our legal department, which usually takes responsibility for FOIA, has been absolutely inundated with requests. I've been told that most of these requests are coming from the media, and that perhaps as time moves on, we'll identify other means by which that same material is available. But what we are now doing is transferring the FOIA intake responsibilities to a senior administrator in university relations. I think that that's probably a very good thing, and I'm sure Mr. Davidson might support that, which gives him a bit more latitude in his department, in the legal department. Mr. Davidson, would you like to make any comments in regards to this before we vote?
I'm happy to, Madam Chair. I appreciate the support of the President and Kathy Bittner in considering the proposal to relocate the primary responsibility for handling the dozens and dozens of requests, and that's probably conservative, that have come to the office since the amendment of the Freedom of Information Act. And because of the limitations on the days, the hours in the day, we asked for some relief on this. And we also asked our colleagues around the state what was the practice at their universities, and we found that it was not uncommon at all for the public information function of the university to be the primary responsible office for handling intake of Freedom of Information Act requests. So coupled with our experience and the common practice elsewhere, it was favorably received by the President and Vice President Bittner to support our request that this be reorganized.
Thank you, Mr. Davidson. Do I have a motion to approve the amendment to our Board of Trustees regulations regarding the Freedom of Information Act laws, and that is to transfer some of the responsibilities to the senior administrator in university relations?
So moved.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Discussion? Trustee Sanchez?
Yeah, I had a question, Chair Muir, of our council. If an issue arises in University Relations Department with regard to potential legal aspects, are you still going to be available to Kathy and her folks should that arise, rather than having lay people having to deal with legal challenges or issues?
Most certainly. And there is a training opportunity that is being provided by the Attorney General's office that will be offered to a number of offices and staff throughout the university, so that there's a more skilled cadre of people who deal with the various requests that may arrive, and that will need some handling at the initial stages. And Greg Brady and I will, of course, continue to be primary legal support for any questions that come up and the proper interpretation of any exemptions that should be applied.
Very good. Very good. Someone else?
So, Kathy, are you going to be the person that's going to be the point person on this?
Yes, it'll be my responsibility. What we're going to do, and what Ken and I have talked about, is to basically we've been kind of doing this informally so for a while now because of the flurry. It just has forced us to do this. We've had Brad Hoy is involved as well. He usually calls any media that requests and finds out exactly what they're looking for to help narrow the scope and find out if we could get it for them without having to go through this extensive administrative process. So we've been working on that. We've got Steve Cunningham, who's frequently involved in pulling data is requested. So there's kind of an informal group that works on these issues anyway, and it would be that kind of group with Ken Davidson and Greg Brady providing backup legal support, because that was my concern as well, not being trained in the law. I don't want the responsibility of making a mistake. So, and we decided to keep it in my office for at least the first few months until we all get trained up properly, because Ken's office is literally 50 feet down the hall, and we wear a path frequently between the two offices. So,
how many requests do you get a month or?
It varies. It's dramatically escalated since the first of the year when the law passed. I would. What do you think, Ken? What, 6 to 8 to 10, somewhere in there?
Well, we get at least 2 or 3 a day. And maybe more on a good day.
can you share with us just a sampling of the kind of requests that you get?
Well, and to be very candid with the board, I get a bit frustrated with some of these requests, because they are requests that we would provide to media often without necessarily having to go through a FOIA request. That triggers an entirely extensive administrative review that frankly costs more time and more money for us to comply. Most of the requests are fairly simple. And that's why I feel comfortable doing this.
Okay.
They're straightforward in the sense that they ask for a copy of a contract or something. Now, those are legitimate requests for documents, which had they asked earlier instead of filing the FOIA, in many cases we would have been able to just give it to them without triggering the entire FOIA review process. So I'm going to be working with the media to try to explain to them that if it is a simple request, if it does involve, we do get occasionally a request that wants people's emails or something like that on a certain subject. And then that automatically would trigger the FOIA review process because that obviously gets into legal issues and things like that. But as far as a simple, you know, contract, which I would say the vast majority of the requests are for copies of contracts that we've entered into as a university, those are fairly straightforward and they're usually not any issue to provide them.
Matt, you had a question.
Yeah, so two things. One, if I understand correctly, the primary rationale behind moving it to university relations is just because university legal has been so burdened with the increased FOIA requests that you guys are going to help and take this on, correct? My second question is that since it seems like this is such a big responsibility, is the way your division is structured currently, are you guys going to be able to handle effectively this responsibility, or are you going to have to do some reorganizing to better accommodate this?
To be determined. We are right now, I think, because of the way we've informally set it up, because we have people like Steve Cunningham, people like myself, people like Brad Hoy, people like Ken and Greg Brady, who have an informal team that have been just dealing with these on a daily basis now for the last couple of months, I think we'll be okay. The level of paperwork and compliance and secretarial support has been, I think, adequately adjusted for, but I'm not certain yet. And it all depends, frankly, on the volume of what we get. I think why working with local media, and that's why university relations is so important in conveying, you know, the fact that we do want to respond to people. We understand this as an institution, and if the request is straightforward, we don't need to file a FOIA. You can just call us and ask for a contract, and that will help reduce the volume substantially.
Okay. Bob?
Kathy, exactly what has changed?
The law.
All right, but what changed in the law?
Ken, you want to explain that better?
There's a shorter response time now.
Yeah.
It's 5 days. It used to be ten days.
Okay, the timing.
That's
the timing is a key thing that has changed. The time available.
The time
of the response. Response
time was
5 days.
Right.
And it was 10.
It was 10.
Okay, so that's one. Okay.
That was the biggest thing, and you had to drop everything you're doing right now. You might have higher real priority items that you're working on for the university, and you've got strict oversight now by the Attorney General's office that is an immediate path to review of anything that you do, and there's consequences for not meeting deadlines. And there has also been a change in several of the exemption areas that's required some explanation within the organization. There's been a wide array of changes in the law that makes it much more, and it's an unfunded mandate. It's more strenuous and difficult for the public body to respond to it.
Okay.
And
thank you.
Limitations on passing the costs on for copying and to the requester, where we have to absorb that. I think it's a public policy regulation that we're getting used to because it is the law. We're accommodating, and I think what's happened is that the FOIA function, and this is me talking as a political scientist now, has morphed to more a research tool that the media has to do their legitimate stories, and so it has become more of a university relations function, and this is much quicker this way because a reporter without a lot of resources now, you know, the news media, they're really stretched, they don't have a lot of research, so they FOIA every transaction for the past 20 years dealing with buying toilet paper. All right, so just tell us what you want. We can get it to you quickly without getting the legal process involved. That's the reason for this.
Once a FOIA is, a request is made, can that be retracted if you are able to say to the media, we have that information, can we just provide it to you outside of that scope?
Yes.
And then they would have to pull their request.
Yes, they actually send us an email or Brad is often the one who talks to the local media. It happens frequently.
Good.
In fact,
okay.
The last few times we've been very successful at doing
good.
That.
All right. Mm-hmm. Would you come back to us at the next committee meeting and bring us an update on
Absolutely.
This? All right. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Question. Kathy, if you've been successful doing this, then why make the change?
I'm going to let Ken Davidson answer that because it's his office that is the one that is inordinately swamped.
Well, we do contact the requester if it's an overly broad request and try to get them to narrow it if they're willing. And if they're not, then we have to refuse it for some reason if it's justified. We do negotiate when we can and where we can. And where it's not possible, then we go into the proper administration of the request. It's a workload problem. I have one assistant who does this with me. Redacting is a big time consumer. I should point out there's a great deal of material that you have to go through page by page, line by line.
But won't you still be doing that?
I won't.
Who will?
John, a point of clarification. I think what Kathy has brought to the board is that this has been an informal process and that there's a request to make it more formal, which is then to transfer some of the intake responsibilities to another department, and that means that we have to have an amendment to our regulation.
This provision places the Vice President of University Relations in charge of the FOIA process. Let me ask this. So it's a big change, and as a board member, I personally have been comforted by the fact that the University Council manages the FOIA request. Who would do the redacting under this new scenario? Who would make the judgment as to what information needed to be removed?
For a standard contract, that there isn't, frankly, much judgment required. We have a standard procedure of redacting all signatures, and frankly, that's, or any kind of personal identification number, a social security number, an FEIN number, taxpayer ID number,
So the answer to the question is you would do this?
With the conjunction, that's what's been happening informally, frequently, between Mr. Davidson, Mr. Brady, Dr. Cunningham, and myself. The part where we really get into the difficulties are when the requests are larger in scope and require, like, university emails and things like that, and that, of course, would then immediately go to legal.
I think we have some choices this morning. We have a motion and a second. I'm going to call for a vote on this. We can ask, and I have already asked Ms. Bittner to report back to this committee at our next session to talk about the process. I think one of the things we are depending upon is the good judgment of the university relations chief, and that is an informal relationship that, as I said, it's been informal. I think that it's important that it stays under Kathy's jurisdiction, at least until we're comfortable, because it does take judgment, and it means that she has to know when to call upon Mr. Davidson. So we have a motion and a second. I'm going to call for a vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
I'm opposed.
One opposed. Motion carried. excuse me. The chief audit executive must review the internal audit charter with senior management and the Board of Trustees in order to comply with the Institute of Internal Auditors' international standards for the professional practice of internal auditing, the Code of Ethics, and the Fiscal Control and Internal Auditing Act of the State of Illinois. The periodic review has been completed and no changes, are needed. The internal auditor has requested board approval of the existing internal audit charter in order to fulfill this requirement. May I have a motion to approve the internal audit charter with no changes?
I'll move.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Are there any questions? Yes.
I'd like to suggest that we make a change so that the notification that's referred to in the third paragraph under the heading Northern Illinois University Internal Audit Department Charter include not only the chair of the Board of Trustees and the committee chair, but also the committee vice chair. I believe that's consistent with the past practice.
Excuse me? Could you just clarify what you just said? I'm sorry.
Yes. The policy has a provision in it that indicates where the reports go, where if corrective action is required. And the way that it reads in this draft is that if corrective action is required, the president shall notify the chair of the Board of Trustees and the committee chair of the LAEA committee. My suggestion is that we also add to that the vice chair of the LAEA committee.
And just so that more people are involved with it?
Just so we make sure that somebody has notice.
Excuse me, that someone has notice. So the motion is has been modified to approve the internal audit charter with the change that Trustee Strauss has indicated.
Okay. I'll second the amended motion.
Do we have discussion?
It's a section in.
Page 28, Bob, the third grammatic paragraph after the title in bold, reading Northern Illinois University Internal Audit Department. That paragraph starts with the word opportunities, and the change would be in the last line.
Now, is that the vice chair of the committee or the vice chair of the board of
trustees? Vice chair of the committee.
Okay. Committee chair.
And vice chair.
Yes, yeah. Correct.
All right, so we're including the committee chair and the vice chair as the modification to this motion.
Correct.
All right. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carried. Dr. Cunningham, I would like to ask you to provide the committee with a thorough analysis of let me modify that. I don't think we're going to have a thorough analysis. Could you give us some of the highlights, sir, of the procurement reform law that takes into effect, that will go into effect July 1st, 2010? We had heard at the Finance Committee meeting that this is a major change in the breadth and scope, and we probably will need to have further discussion once it's put into effect after July. But what we're most concerned about is how does that impact the role and responsibilities of the Board of Trustees and any of the officers of the university?
Yes, sounds good, and I will be as brief as possible. As Chair Muir mentioned early in the meeting with the CSRS legislation, this too reflects a major change in the nature of public policy in the state of Illinois, somewhat reflecting the crisis, the fiscal crisis, as well as the crisis with various issues in state government. We have a PowerPoint presentation to kind of briefly go through this, but which Media Services is going to help with. Thank you. Senate Bill 51 was passed in the spring of 2009, and we did report to this committee then in June briefly about the contents of Senate Bill 51. At that time, higher ed developed strategies to work with the Ethics Commission and other sectors of state government to seek to modify or amend the Senate bill in order to make it more well fit with the procedures in higher education and also the authorities of the universities and the boards of trustees. The governor did mandatorily veto the bill. There were some changes in that. However, that veto was overridden by the General Assembly. So as of today, moving into the July 1 effective date, Senate Bill 51 is very much unchanged from the way that it was passed originally pursuant to the leadership in the House of Representatives. It was passed under the rubric of ethics reform. It was related to the ethics reform packages and is very much tied to that agenda. So next slide, please. There are some key definitions both under the current procurement code as well as following the enactment of this new statute. The Illinois Procurement Code was established in 1998 as a means to structure the purchases of large transactions in state government. It established bidding procedures, checks and balances, and a heavily regulated system of state procurement. At that time, Illinois, the public universities developed a consortium called IPEC, the Illinois Procurement Higher Education Cooperative. And this is a participatory function. It is housed at the University of Illinois. and all of the universities subscribe to it. And the IPEC submits bids. They maintain then what's called the procurement bulletin, which is an online bidding process for all types of transactions in higher education. It works very well. It's designed to follow the procurement code and assure compliance with the procurement code as well. It's very efficient. It gives us opportunities to collectively bid on large commodities, goods, and services. There was established in 2005 as part of ethics compliance at that time, a procurement policy board to oversee the actions of all of state government with respect to procurement. And that board has the ability to review all transactions. It can limit it. Implementation of transactions for 30 days while it undertakes a review, and it can require hearings with respect to sole sources. The procurement code requires the appointment of a chief procurement officer for each sector of state government, including higher education. And under the current code, that individual was appointed by the university agencies, by the presidents through agreement, and that person has been the chief operating officer at the University of Illinois because of their association with IPEC. The chief procurement officer then, subject to the approval of the presidents and each agency, appoints a state procurement officer to assure compliance with the procurement code at the agency level. And I have that role, for example, at Northern at the present time. Of course, the Executive Ethics Commission was established in 2003 with the State Officials and Employees Ethics Act. And the Procurement Compliance Monitor is a new term that we'll discuss here toward the end of our presentation. Next slide, please. There are three basic types of procurement: competitive, which is bid, sole source, where there is no other logical supplier, and then emergency procurements for health, safety, and the protection of facilities. Next slide, please. The current bid thresholds, which get us into the procurement code for these different types of transactions, are reflected here: $20,000 for professional artistic services, $50,000 for supplies and just general services, construction, $70,100. That goes up by inflation, and A&E services, $25,000. The bottom section sort of demonstrates what the annual procurement activity is in higher education subject to the code, where there are around 2,600 bid transactions on the procurement that are listed on the procurement bulletin, and 730 or 22% of those are sole source transactions. Many, and we have these in almost every board committee, has a vendor named in a grant. And those are examples of sole source transactions where a specific vendor is named in a grant. Now, next slide, please. This is just a brief organizational chart for how the procurement system works in higher education right now. Beginning with the authority of the governing boards to delegate procurement transactions to the universities. The universities undertake procurement. Our procurement service office, services area works with that. Becky May is our manager. She's back. Raise your hand, Becky, because she's got to work with this new code as well when we get started. And then we interact with the procurement code. And then this box of four quadrants where we have the CPO, the SPO at the institution level, the IPEC cooperative interacting with the procurement policy board. That's the statewide apparatus. And you'll see there, though, that currently three-fourths of that are governed by positions that are central to higher education, that being the CPO, the SPO, and IPEC. And then the transaction is completed in accordance with the procurement code. Next slide, please. Now, this is a demonstration of the set of new positions that would be created under the enactment of Senate Bill 51. These are all new positions. Procurement authority is moved to the Executive Ethics Commission. There are four CPOs appointed, one for each major sector of state government: capital development, transportation, higher education, and CMS. and those are appointed by the Ethics Commission, not by those state governmental agencies. And then each university, each agency will have a separate state procurement officer, SPO, as well as what we call a procurement compliance monitor, appointed by the Ethics Commission, reporting outside of our organization. So we have here at least 26 positions, new positions, to oversee procurement in higher education. Now, how this will eventually play out, we're in the early stages of it, leading to July 1, but thus far nothing has changed with respect to just a very straightforward implementation of Senate Bill 51 as it was legislated. The next slide then sort of gives you a picture of the new chart of operations for procurement following enactment of the statute. We still have university governing authority and procurement operations and the procurement code, but we cannot actually undertake any transactions until they have been authorized by the chief procurement officer and the state procurement officer for our institution, appointed by the Ethics Commission. The Ethics Commission will effectively have the governing authority for all procurement and state government. We'll still have an IPEC, and we'll still have have the Procurement Policy Board out there additionally reviewing transactions. And then we'll have a procurement compliance monitor on site to review transactions as well. And finally, we'll complete our procurement transactions. So that now the box of four is now 75% controlled outside of the organization. I know we're about out of time. Kathy says 2 minutes. So we'll move to the next slide. This is a diagram prepared by the University of Illinois just to get, that's a play action. Just to give a sense of the crisscrossing intersections of authorities and transaction requirements that we envision following enactment of this new bill. Next slide, please. Yes.
In 25 words or less, kind of give us a summation in terms of what does this really mean? What does this mean to us, and what does it mean to us between now and July 1st, and our next board meeting?
And this is a good final slide to have that discussion. Between now and July, all of state government, especially higher education, is working and collaborating with the Ethics Commission among the institutions, and we've developed different subcommittees to work on different aspects of implementation. So we're working very diligently to be prepared to still operate under the new requirements, which are far more complex than what we operate under now. It will have the effect of without looking at the language in the statute, of transferring procurement authority to the chief procurement officer, who will report to the Ethics Commission, an employee of the Ethics Commission. And that individual, through these state procurement officers that they too will appoint, will be the authorizing parties for all of our procurement transactions, regardless of fund source, as of the effective date of the act.
There's another level, another layer put upon us that is state-imposed layer.
Yes, ma'am.
And that layer is not even physically here, whereas before the physical authority, the authority was physically here.
Yes.
At the university.
Yes.
So that's where the disconnect is.
Correct. Correct. And those authorities will have the ability to issue rules, procedures, void transactions and hold the progress of transactions pursuant to their roles.
And these rules are applied to us regardless of the amount of money that we receive from the university, simply because of the fact we are a state university. So
correct.
Even if we were to receive no monies from the state, hypothetically, this would still be imposed because of the nature of our structure. Is that correct?
It would, and again, it's independent of fund source. So
yes.
whether it's appropriated funds, non-appropriated funds, grant funds, it is all covered under the procurement code.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Steve. Are there
you.
Any questions, Mr. Cunningham?
Yeah. In 25 words or less, we're doing our share to reduce unemployment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's it's very disturbing because what we've been hearing today, not only here but in other instances, is that it becomes more and more complex in a time, as Dr. Peters said, we need to be more and more streamlined. Rules are good, but they have to have a purpose. So, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yes.
Question.
Yes.
Are there any changes required to our board regulations as a result of this statutory change?
We don't see any at this time. The board regulations do set up different internal protocols for authorizing procurement transactions. Those will still apply. These new rules mainly relate to how we then carry out those transactions after they're authorized.
But so far as you're aware, there's nothing that you will need from us before July 1, then, in order to be able to do what's required by the statute?
No, just your awareness.
Thank you.
It would be great.
Thank you. I do want to make mention of the fact that we had been committed to continue our discussion regarding domestic partner issues. We will defer that discussion till our next LAEA meeting due to the shortness of time of this meeting, but I did want to make sure that it was on the record and on our agenda. That next meeting will be August 26th, I believe, August 26th in DeKalb. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second? We're adjourned. Thank you. Beginning a special board meeting.